Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Tuesday, I think. Okay, so this is one of those weeks where I've like already completely lost track of time and day. So welcome to Connecting Faith. If you're like me here, well, the school year has already started where I am. I know for other people, this is the last week of summer. I know for some of you, the only thing relevant about this week is that the Minnesota State Fair is going on. So let me just go ahead and warn you in advance or share with you in advance or invite you in advance. On Thursday during the program, I would like to be taking your calls and reflections and celebrations either from the state fair or from your trip to the state fair. So there you go. So setting it out there in advance. So if you've already been or if you're going in the next couple of days, we're going to want to hear reports. You know, how is it that even at the state fair, there are opportunities for the intersection of faith and real life? How did you get God back into a conversation? Or where were there things that you saw, heard, or experienced that you were thinking to yourself, wow, I wonder how Carmen would get God back into that conversation? So there you go. I'll just set that out there as an opportunity. Also, later in today's show, actually just in about 10 minutes from now, I am going to be joined by Art Rayner. He and I have talked here on the program before about God and money. And money and marriage and all things money. And actually, Art's going to take your calls today and listener questions that we receive either via the phone or over the text line. That number is the same, whether you call it or text it, 877-933-2484. So if you've got a question at the intersection of money and faith and life, we'll be taking calls throughout the middle portion of today's program. So in selecting the headline for today, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you it's pretty troubling. I got a listener question a couple of days ago about like how do I go about searching through the news, scanning the news, aggregating information and news, and then you know bringing it to you to lift up ways in which we can enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. And so actually in putting that list together, I realized I left one thing off, and that is this. I actually do read other headlines from other places. It is interesting to me how other people around the world are talking about us as Americans, and particularly as American Christians. The world seems to still think that or imagine that this is a Christian country. And so they actually imagine that what we do here reflects Christ. And so I think it's instructive to know how it is that the rest of the world reports on what's happening here in America. And so I bring you a headline today from The Guardian. The Guardian is a print publication, also online, and it's from the UK. And so here's the headline, Inside the Secret Network Providing Home Abortions Across the United States. And here is a paragraph from the article. Anna was joining a loose underground network of 45 women who had learned how to provide home abortions. It has since grown to around 200 women across the United States, but because the network is decentralized, there are actually no complete records of how many pregnancies they have brought to an end. According to interviews with providers in the network, note how those people are referred to, by the way, providers in the network. When you and I think of providers in a network, we think about healthcare providers in an approved network that our insurance company, you know, tells us we can use. So when that language is used, providers in the network, you know, that there's a process that goes on in the mind that says, hey, this is an okay, legit form of healthcare. And let me just stop right there and say it is not. Okay, so back to the article. According to interviews with providers in the network, a conservative estimate is that more than 2,000 abortions have been performed in homes by these women in the past 3 years. This is the United States of America, friends. This is not in some third world country. This is not even in a country where abortion is illegal or where access to abortion is limited in any way. This is right here in the USA. The article goes on. These women and their clients, again, you know, look at the language here. These people are being paid for what they're doing. So this is significant as well. These women and their clients risk imprisonment and fines if caught. Since 2000, at least 15 women have been arrested or criminally investigated for ending their own pregnancies. and 6 people for aiding someone who did. Anna thought her job was about 10% abortion care. Abortion care, she'd look at that language. It's actually, you know, performing an abortion, and 90% emotional care. So when we look at that language, one of the things that I think we need to see is that what is being described here is the work of a doula. I don't know if you're familiar with this concept, but a doula is a person who comes alongside and ushers in life. That's what a doula does. It's not actually a midwife. It's a person who comes alongside a pregnant woman and offers emotional support throughout the birth and then following the birth during the mother's physical recovery. So what we're talking about here is a death doula, an abortion doula. We're not talking here about midwifery. We're not talking here about traditional doulas, people who come alongside a woman in her childbirth travail and actually assist her emotionally. We are talking about a death doula. We're talking about the growth of an industry in the United States of America of abortion doulas. And here's the part of Anna's story from the article so that you can understand who this woman is. 4 years after her child was born, Anna became pregnant again. She could not afford another kid. That was her own judgment. She had quit college. She had quit midwifery school because of the cost. She was supporting her unemployed boyfriend along with her preschooler. Oh, by the way, it's not in this part of the article, but we also know that she is she's a dancer at an adult club. She had read online that certain combinations would actually bring about a miscarriage, and I'm not going to read that portion to you. Let's suffice it to say it didn't work, so she didn't know what else to do, and so she took herself to a clinic where she paid cash, and then that experience is described. It is quite unpleasant. It ends with her having a sense of shame and a sense of guilt, things that she did not want other women who have an abortion to ever feel, and thus she enters into this abortion doula business so that other people will have access to abortion and this emotional support that she feels like she did not get, as if emotional support causes the problem of the shame and guilt. And so I lift this up because I'm so troubled by this. This is a testimony of a woman who now regularly ends the lives of the preborn through a number of what are called at-home abortion methods. And I actually think that her testimony here in The Guardian may well define the future of abortion in America. Today in America, we have an increasing number of women who are turning to these at-home abortion, do-it-yourself abortion practices. Sometimes there is a doula involved. Other times it's simply ordering pharmaceuticals online and killing their unborn children through chemical abortion. So I want to know, how did we go from midwives to abortion doulas? How did we go from a culture of life to a culture of death? Well, we got here over a course of at least 40 years, during which more than 60 million American children have been aborted by their own mothers. And so when we start talking about a reconstituted Supreme Court that may revisit and may even reverse the 1974 Roe v. Wade decision declaring the right to abortion, or actually declaring abortion a right in America, I think we have to ask ourselves, would such a reversal actually do anything at all, to limit the number of abortions that women would actually commit in this country? It certainly would return decision-making about that to the states, but it would not change the reality of these easy-to-get drugs for do-it-yourself abortions. And it certainly would not change the secret network of people who are providing home abortions across the United States, these women who I am calling abortion doulas. So there's an article at the Reason.com blog that talks about these easy-to-administer abortion-inducing pills and the impossibility of stopping the flow of these foreign pharmaceuticals into our country. It also, you know, that article also talks about the difference between a medical and a chemical or pharmaceutical abortion. And so I guess I want to ask the question, what does it mean to be pro-life here and now in the United States at this point in time? First of all, I think we have to be pro-life for all of life and for every life. We actually have to care about moms like Anna. We have to care about women who are in the sex industry. And we have to care about women who are in industries like Anna is in, and circumstances like Anna is in. We have to honestly have networks of healthy people into whom these women can be absorbed and loved and cared for. We've got to support pro-life pregnancy centers in our communities, and we need to become doulas who emotionally support pregnant women through the process, especially women who feel like they have no access to a healthy network of relationships that they could rely upon during and after their pregnancy. I think we also have to seriously consider how we can better support single moms, like really support them. And so those would be some considerations. And then I think that, you know, we actually have to stand against the culture of death. Do you remember the story in Exodus chapter 1 about the Hebrew midwives who defied Pharaoh and let the Hebrew babies live? At the end of Exodus chapter 1, you know, we learn that although Pharaoh had commanded that every single one of these Hebrew boys should be killed by these Hebrew midwives, and that didn't work, he then issued the edict that every son born to the Hebrews should be cast into the Nile. And in chapter 2, we learn that one of those baby boys is Moses. It's a lot to consider today. I know that it's heavy stuff, but this is a conversation that is going on in the darkness. And I think it ought to be happening in the light. Next up, we're going to talk with and take your calls on the subject of money and marriage. Joining me will be Art Rayner. He's the author of The Money Challenge. He's also the vice president for institutional advancement at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's going to be here to answer your questions next on Connecting Faith. The number to text or call, 877-933-2484. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined today by Art Rayner. You know him. We have talked with him before about his book, The Money Challenge. He is also the vice president for institutional advancement at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's got all kinds of fancy degrees that make him a really good person to talk to about money and money management. And he's experienced in marriage. So there you go. We're going to talk with him today about the intersection of money and marriage and the questions that you all have. So, Art, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thanks for so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So we've been letting our listeners know for a couple of days now that you were going to be on, and we invited them to submit questions. We've also opened the phone line. So let me remind people that the phone lines are open. You can either call or text 877-933-2484. But Art, to stimulate the conversation to get things going, how about I just read to you a listener question that was submitted?
Okay, that sounds great.
All right, so this person says, I don't know how to talk to my kids about the value of money. My parents never talked about money except when there simply wasn't enough. There was stressful yelling and tears, but no conversation about budgeting or what we all might do together to make things work. I want to do better, but I have no idea where to even start. They have lots of things. I assume this means my kids have lots of things, but want more. How do I teach them the value of what things cost and what it costs me in terms of work to make the money to buy those things?
Well, you know, I was the greatest parent the world has ever known right before I had kids. And so I can relate to these questions. I have three boys, ages 8, 5, and 2. And I can relate to what this listener is saying. And the first suggestion that I have is actually what I did this morning was to make sure that every day you're on your knees praying for your kids and praying for your parenting, because the reality as parents, we need a lot of mercy and grace because we can help them to change their behaviors, but that's not really what we're tasked with as parents. We're tasked to raise our kids with eternity in mind, and so we're working to guide them to Christ and to teach them about the things of God. So pray for your kids. Of course, that doesn't mean that you need to stop parenting. You do need to parent. You do need to show them how to do things, especially in the area of money. So my second suggestion is to teach them the joy of generosity. Help them experience the joy of generosity. And I know this may sound a little counterintuitive because you're talking about your kids wanting more stuff. But the reality is, whether it's adults or even kids, the antidote to materialism is generosity. And so I'm constantly looking for easy on-ramps to teach my kids about generosity, help them to understand the importance of generosity. Just as a quick example, of course, we encourage our kids to give to our church whenever they have allowance money. But there was a commercial on television about this organization that was helping raise awareness for lions. It was either lions or tigers, and how their habitats was being destroyed, and they encouraged the viewer to give money toward that cause. Well, my oldest son was immediately, because he loves tigers and lions, he was immediately captured by that, and he said, "Daddy, I want to give. I want to give to this." And my response was, "Yes, absolutely." And the reason why I said yes was not because it's not that I'm unpassionate about tigers and lions. I absolutely care for them. But I wanted him to be able to experience what it's like to give and to be generous. And so I encourage them, any time that I see a little easy on-ramp, I encourage them in that direction. The other thing that I recommend to parents is to help them understand that money is finite, so that there's a limited supply of money, that mom and dad don't necessarily have this money tree in the back where they can just fulfill any needs and any desires, any material desires that the kids want. So talk about it. It's okay to say, you know what, we actually don't have the money for that. And maybe even take them out shopping and show them prices and how money works and say, look, I have $5 in my hands. You see, this cost $5.99. Therefore, we can't buy it. We can't buy it with this amount of money. So find ways to teach them that money is finance. So those are some things that I'm working on as a parent right now. Once again, I'm not going to say that I am the absolute most successful parent out there. A lot of that's still to be determined because my boys are young. But we're constantly trying to encourage them and push them toward generosity and focus on using their money for those things as opposed to using money on themselves.
Oh, Art, I so appreciate that. Friends, if you want to call or text us a question, the phone lines are open, 877-933-2484. As you were making reference to the money tree, I was recalling this friend of mine. Her name is Kate. She lives on Hilton Head. And I remember this parenting lesson. This comes from a number of years ago. I mean, I was actually sitting with her family, and one of her boys was insisting on something, whatever it was, I have no idea. And she just looked at him and she says, "You know what? Just go out there to the money tree. Go get what you need from the money. You know, from the money tree." And he just looked at her, and she said, "Go ahead. Go. You know, you think there's a money tree? You know, go out there." So it was one of those like bring him up short, right, parenting moments. And I appreciated it. I mean, you know, she went on to talk about, you know, with him, the fact that we have a lemon tree, we have a palm tree, we don't have a money tree. You know, this is how money comes into our family system. And then she, you know, she reminded him that, you know, they have sat down as a family and they have actually gone over their family budget. And so I think those are, when you talk about showing them, I also think that for this particular listener who grew up in a house where money was really never talked about except in relationship to scarcity, I think that sharing with our kids the family budget and really so they can see, you know, what's coming in and what's going out. I mean, obviously at the right age and stage of life, but I do think that from the earliest stage that we can, helping them understand a budget is really helpful.
Absolutely. And just talking about money in general is a good thing. We tell our kids about how we give to our church. Money is a regular conversation in our household. It's not just because I write on it and talk on it. It's because we know that it's important. We know that it's important for them to understand how money works. And so we're trying our best to shepherd them, to teach them about money, in hopes that they'll one day and continue to experience God's design for them and their money, and that's to live and give generously. And so, once again, we're parenting for eternity, and so we're pointing them in that direction and showing them God's ways.
Okay, we have another question from a listener. This is, brace yourself. All right, this listener is apparently a female. She says, "My husband spends money outside of our budget. My passive-aggressive response is to go and do likewise. I know it's wrong. I know two wrongs don't make a right, but I want to punish him. Making the financial situation worse is one way to do that. Please help me.
Well, in our marriages, whether we're dealing with money or anything else, we're to pursue oneness, right? I mean, that's what the Bible tells us, is that as a married couple, we're to pursue oneness. You see this in Genesis 2:24. You see it in 1 Corinthians 7:4, where Paul says that, you know, even your own body is, if you're married, is no longer your own. The most personal thing that you have is no longer your own. And so we're constantly trying to pursue oneness, whether it's with anything that happens. Of course, that includes our finances. Now, I don't recommend being passive-aggressive, and I appreciate that she acknowledges that that's probably not the best approach. When I hear questions like this, my first thought is that, okay, this actually doesn't sound like a money issue. Mm. It sounds like it's manifesting itself in their finances. But it sounds like it's more of a trust issue. Once again, it just happens to reveal itself in the area of money. It sounds like this wife probably feels a little betrayed, and that they're definitely not on the same page, especially in the terms of in the realm of finances. So I would recommend that she goes and talks to her husband, not about the money, but about what it represents, that there's a reason for her disappointment and her frustration, and it's really about trust, that there's a trust issue present in their relationship. And I'm hoping that the husband will respond maybe in a different way, because you're no longer arguing about money, you're talking about something that's very, very deep and real. Not that money's not, but it's just manifesting itself in its finances.
And also, I find myself wondering as I consider this listener's situation, you know, her needs are related to security, certainly. I mean, every woman is wired that way. His needs are related to respect or some kind of affirmation that he's probably not receiving from her in some other area of life. And so maybe my question back to our listener here is, what's your husband need? If what you're needing is, you know, is to know that he's going to, you know, respect this budget that you all have developed together, what does he need that maybe you as a wife need to be considering in this conversation? Hey, friends, we're going to continue this conversation with Art Rayner after the break. If you want to call or text us your money and marriage related question, we are at 877-933-2484. Again, that's 877-933-2484. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith. Friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, joined in conversation today by our friend Art Rayner. He is the author of The Money Challenge. He's also the Vice President for Institutional Advancement at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. I've also just learned that his pastor is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, so that's kind of cool. I mean, of all the things you got going on, Art, you got that going on too.
Yeah, it's been quite an adventure, and we're proud of him, grateful for his leadership here in North Carolina and now beyond.
Yeah, well, we pray for him regularly, so we appreciate what he's doing. Okay, so before we went to the break, I offered a partial I made a little contribution to the answer to the question that was raised about spending money outside of a family budget and how that might be addressed. You, during the break, made me aware that I had made an assumption. I would like for you to share your observation with our listening audience.
Well, you said that the budget was their budget, that they had come up with the budget together. And I would say more often than not, that's usually just not the case. It's usually either the husband comes up with the budget or the wife comes up with the budget, and then they deliver it to the to their spouse, and they say, here, this is what we need to do. And unfortunately, that can actually, because it's just one, developing the budget, it can actually bring tension in the marriage, especially revolving around the area of finances. And so what I recommend is first, and this is going to seem very simple, but you first, as a couple, need to agree that you need to agree. You need to agree that you need to get on the same page with your finances. Then you need to look at the reality of your finances, look at how much debt you have, what your net worth is, so your assets minus your liabilities. And then you need to dream together. You need to have a fun conversation with your spouse, maybe over a cup of coffee, and talk about what do you what would you like to see happen in the future, whether 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and you start developing some goals together. Now, it, that doesn't mean that you're going to always get exactly what you want, and you're not going to always chase the exact goals that you want to chase. There should be a lot of compromise going on because you have two people coming together to develop one plan. And then you create a budget, which is just simply a plan. Most people avoid, and they hate the word budget. Budget is just a plan to help you get to whatever financial goals that, that you may have. And so as a couple, make sure you're crafting that budget together so that when you then spend maybe more than you should in your budget, it, you understand why your spouse is holding you accountable, because you all had this conversation, and it's preventing you all from achieving the goals that you both have agreed that you wanted to achieve. And so make sure that you're on the same page and that you're developing the budget or the plan together.
Oh, I really appreciate that, Art. I think that one of the things that I really didn't consider in that question and in that conversation was the very practical reality that one of these two people created the budget, and the person who's operating outside of the budget is probably not the one who created it. And so,
that's very likely.
Yeah. So I think you've really surfaced some really important things there. I like the agree to agree. I like the let's plan to get together to our goals. And that means that we not only look at the reality that we're in now, but we dream together. What do we want to see happen down the road? And then we construct our current budget based on all of that. So we've got some things that we have to spend now, but if we're going to set some aside to save, what are we saving that for? What's the over and above going to be dedicated to? And that's something we've agreed upon together. Is a part of our, you know, building our own dream. So I love that. That's wonderful. Friends, again, my conversation partner is Art Rayner. The book is The Money Challenge. And we're taking your questions today. So if you want to call or text us, you can do so at 877-933-2484. I have a number of questions that listeners have submitted. So I'm just going to move here to the next one. This is about a decision making related to a church building campaign. This listener says, our church is having a building campaign. I want to support it, but it's definitely not in the budget. Do I go into debt to support the church?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I love the heart behind the question, because there's a desire to give. So I appreciate the heart behind it. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to make my own assumption with that question, and that's that they're already making giving a priority. So this building campaign, this building project that the church wants to, if they were to give to that building campaign, this would be an above and beyond gift that's outside of their normal giving. And having said all that, the answer is no. You shouldn't go into debt, even if you want to make an above and beyond a gift, because what you're doing is you're actually hindering your future generosity. You see, debt is a major generosity killer. And so by you taking on more debt, you're actually limiting what you're going to be able to do, not just in the future, but right now as well. And so if it is not an above and beyond gift, so if it's not, if you're not giving and you're saying, okay, now I want to give, then there needs to be a hard look at the budget and a hard look at your finances, which I know we don't have those details, But giving needs to be a priority. That's what the Bible teaches. We need to make giving a priority. We need to make sure it's done proportionally, sacrificially, and cheerfully. And so if that's not taking place, then there absolutely needs to be some work on the budget, or debt needs to be paid off so that you can do that. But if this is an above and beyond gift, no, I would not go into debt. Try to work with your finances to get yourself in the place to where that becomes, where you can say yes to those types of generosity opportunities.
Okay, I love that. All right, I am going to jump to this question. How do I overcome my love of stuff? I know I need to literally clean house and get rid of lots of material baggage, actual bags of stuff currently in my house. But every morning and every night, I walk past them. Sometimes I even close my eyes and shake my head in denial. Man, our love of stuff robs us of all kinds of opportunities, Art. It's clearly weighing this person down. So, you know, help us with the love of stuff. I think this is a consumerism question.
Yeah, absolutely. And because of the way that we're bombarded with social media, with these images of people enjoying these incredible vacations and experiences, it makes us feel like we're constantly being left out. And so it pushes us to pursue a lifestyle that our finances can't support. And often we're actually chasing something that's a facade that they can't really afford it either. They're just swiping their credit card. The first question that you had asked dealt with kids and their desire for stuff and for more toys. And this, it's actually a pretty similar question. Now, I have a very similar answer. The antidote to materialism is generosity. In Proverbs 18:1, it says, "One who isolates himself pursues selfish desires. He rebels against all sound wisdom." So one who isolates himself pursues selfish desires. So here's my suggestion to this listener. Get around some people that have some real needs. Get where it's helping out at a homeless shelter. Find a place where there's some people that have some real significant needs. So don't isolate yourself. Start surrounding yourself with people that allow your eyes to be open to the needs that are around you. And then what will inevitably happen is that God will work in your heart, and you'll start to have a desire to meet those needs. And all of a sudden, you'll not necessarily walk past those bags of stuff and just ignore it. In fact, you may even decide to pick up one of those bags and take it with you and donate it and think about and meditate on the impact that that's actually having on somebody's life. See, whereas just I don't know if it's a wall decoration or a hallway decoration or however that bag of stuff, wherever it was placed, in your house, and is doing absolutely nothing, now that stuff is doing something significant for somebody else. And see how that feels. And I can guarantee you that if you do that, the second bag will find its way out of the house, and then the third and the fourth. Because once again, the antidote to materialism is generosity.
Oh, that's so good. I think that just looking around at all the stuff we have and considering how some of it might be repurposed to bless other people is really freeing. That's actually a really encouraging answer to the question. So thank you for that, because I do sense a hint of isolation in the person's question. And so I think you've addressed that as well. So that's just excellent. Again, friends, my conversation partner is Art Rayner. He's the Vice President for Institutional Advancement at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's also the author of a lot of books, but the most recent one is The Money Challenge. He also has one about just living life more simply that I really appreciate. Okay, Art, we got time for one more question here, so I'm going to give you this one. They didn't even frame it as a question. This is more like a statement, but it gets back to, I think, the conversation about our sense of what we can and cannot afford. So here's what the listener wrote. Paying for private Christian school. We can't afford it, but we also feel like we can't afford not to.
Well, that's a good question, and a question that I can relate to. So I went to a private Christian school. when I was younger. My wife went to public school all of her life. And so we've actually had this very conversation, the conversation, should our kids go to a private Christian school or not? And we both bring to the table different perspectives. And just to know what we've decided on right now is our kids are going to the public school. That's what we think is best for our kids and for our family right now. And so here's my encouragement to the parent, and once again, I can truly relate to what they're saying, but a private school is not a foolproof way to ensure your child is a child who loves and pursues God. That's not the foolproof way to ensure that they become a follower that is passionate about pursuing Christ. It is a tool. It can be a tool. But I can tell you from personal experience, there's many in my high school graduating class that went on to ministry and did and are currently doing great things for God. Simultaneously, there's many who graduated from that school and are no longer following Christ. And so it's a tool, but it's not a silver bullet. And so the most influential person in your kid's life is you. And there is more power in a child seeing you, whether you're a mom or a dad, in the Word, praying on your knees in the morning, than 1,000 school chapel services. So don't let private education ruin you and your child's financial future. And I want to make sure that this is very clear. You need to care about your finances for the sake of your kids. It's just like when you're in an airplane, they tell you be sure to put on your oxygen mask first before you hand it to your child. It's the same thing. You need to take care of your finances so that you can take care of your children. Because if you ruin your finances, they're the ones that are going to be taking care of you in adulthood. And so make sure that you're taking care of your finances for their sake. So you can still be a good parent and send your kids to public school. So if you cannot afford it, that's okay. It is an optional tool that's out there, but it is not the silver bullet. You walking with Christ, showing them what it's like, is much more powerful than any attendance at a Christian school.
Oh, Art, that's just so helpful. Thank you so much for joining us today. Friends, again, that's Art Rayner. The book is The Money Challenge. Art, if folks want to follow up with you, is there a preferred social media where they can do that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, and so my handle is at Art Rayner, so ArtRainer, and that's also my Instagram account. And just really, if you type in Art Rayner, there's not too many of us out there. If you type Art Rayner into your Google search, there's not too many of us out there. You'll be able to find me.
Love it. Hey, Art, thanks again so much. All right, friends, we've got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, welcome back. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We're going to make the connecting point, but before we do that, I have to apologize to Art. I kept calling his book by the wrong title. So it's actually The Marriage Challenge, a finance guide for married couples. So you're looking for The Marriage Challenge, not The Money Challenge. So I totally apologize. Even though he's not on anymore, but hopefully he will get the message and the spirit of it. Okay, so I've been telling you that I was going to share with you my notes from the Christian Transhumanist. It was the Christian Transhumanism conference that took place on Saturday. Now I will admit I was skeptical. I asked for your prayers in advance, if you recall, because what I knew of the secular transhumanism movement was all about transcending the physical body, sort of a post-human reality, getting beyond humanity. And so let me just say right here at the outset, I was pleasantly surprised to find many genuinely Christian people who are like wildly smart and experts in the fields of science, technology, and they are interested in engaging with the existing transhumanism conversation from a distinctively Christian worldview. Now, let me be clear. I am not saying that every speaker, and certainly not every participant, was a Christian. I talked to a woman in the hallway who was actually horribly disappointed that she had driven from, I don't know, like 4 or 5 hours away to come to the conference, which clearly had the word Christian at the beginning of it. And then she was just intensely offended at how Christian the people who were speaking were. Now, I will say that far from all the speakers being Christian, there were some speakers who were clearly not Christian. But the event organizer, whose name is Micah Redding, made the purpose of the event perfectly clear. He said, transhumanism is a conversation at the intersection of science, technology, and human realities to which Christians are arriving late. But it's also a place where we have something to offer. We bring what secularists simply don't have. We bring values and virtues of love, compassion, and cooperation into a conversation that often focuses on a pragmatic application of technology to problems. And it only does so for a limited few. Then he said, Christian transhumanism recognizes that human beings, each human being and every human being, is made in the image of a creating, organizing God who builds technology and societies. So how do we shape those, technology and societies, by the way, how do we shape those toward genuinely good and not just consumerist impulses? So that's really what the day focused on. It was a lot of super smarty pants conversation about science and technology and all kinds of advances that I will just admit to you I was not terribly familiar with. But it was definitely a conversation about what values and meaning Christians could bring to the conversation, how Christians could be the voice of positive relational values within a larger transhumanist discourse. And you're saying to yourself, I didn't even know there was a transhumanist discourse. I don't even know what that is. I don't know what conversation they're talking about trying to jump into. Well, that may be because you and I are very busy in Middle Earth. And these are people who seem to be operating at the stratospheric level in terms of their education and cultural engagement. So let me just give you, I'll give you my primary takeaway. My primary takeaway is that these are very smart people who want technology to serve transcendental values and not simply serve the rich or the powerful who could afford to capitalize on technology for their personal super longevity or cryogenic or AI immortality. Okay, and you're saying to yourself, what is she even talking about today? She's lost her mind. Okay, well, so it was, I was intrigued. I'll just admit I was intrigued. I've never actually before wanted to spend $180 on a book, and yet I was introduced to an author at this event, and that's what his book cost. And so I'm like evaluating, how is it possibly worth that? I don't know. I'll let you know. I'm studying my budget to see whether or not I'm going to go that direction. Let me give you a couple of takeaways from two different speakers. One was Ted Peters. Ted Peters is a Lutheran theologian. He's the professor of systematic theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. He's the author of a book entitled God, the World's Future, and another book entitled Science, Theology, and Ethics. He's the editor of Theology and Science at the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences at Berkeley. I thought he was fascinating. And in this particular context, he was certainly a generation older than every, and then all of the other speakers. In fact, I would say two generations older than many of the speakers who were very diverse and very young. He talked about the promise and peril of technological hope. He also, I think, helped me understand sort of the basic conversation about transhumanism. And so I found his presentation particularly helpful. He said there's really only two views of the future, futurum and adventus. And so when we talk about futurum, we're talking about the idea that all possibilities for the future are already present, already exist in the present. It's a little bit like saying everything that's possible already exists in the acorn. okay? And you're saying to yourself, well, no, I mean, the acorn is great, but, you know, God might just spring up a tree. Well, yes, God might spring up a tree, and that would be the Adventist view of the future. Focus on the word Advent there, and you will begin to say, aha, I know what she's talking about. So the Adventist claims that things without precedent are actually coming at us. The future is then apocalyptic. The system is open. From the Futurum viewpoint, the future is progressive and the system is closed. And so I actually just felt like that distinction, learning that distinction, was particularly helpful in understanding the conversations taking place among the technology science crowd. He talked about technological process, progress, and then he talked about a variety of views of transhumanism. And this is where I want to take a minute to walk through these so that when you hear the word transhumanism, you can ask the follow-up question. When you say transhumanism, what do you mean by that? And then you will know, because I'm going to tell you, what Christian transhumanism then can contribute to that conversation, or what you as a Christian can then contribute to the conversation. So here are the different, we'll call them varieties, but I'm not even sure that's the right term. Transhumanism, sort of, there's some people who understand transhumanism as the next step in human evolution. Here, I think we should consider like nanotech applications in the area of like biotech. We talk about CRISPR technology, deep brain implants, other human enhancements through AI. So for this group of people, the highest value is intelligence. And so making a super intelligent human being through enhancements is viewed then as transhumanism, or the next step in human evolution. And it's actually a human governed or human created evolutionary step. Now you can see how quickly this leads to drastic human divisions, where some people would have access to these enhancements and others would not. And the negative consequences for masses of people are very, very real. There's another view of transhumanism as overcoming death. So here you could think radical life extension. There was actually a speaker at this event who wholeheartedly believes and is working toward solving not only the aging problem, but therefore the death problem. Yes, they are actually talking about people living here on Earth for 1,000 years, which, of course, changes a view of a lot of things, changes our view of aging and death. But it also, you know, creates huge new questions, which this person does not seem terribly concerned about. But the biggest question would be, who gets to live for 1,000 years? Because obviously not everybody would have access to all of these medical and technological advances that would enhance the human body in a way that it would allow it to live for 1,000 years. So then there is transhumanism as cybernetic immortality. That's living beyond your body through, you know, having your brain basically uploaded. And then there's transhumanism as singularity, which is like genuine evolution. Think here X-Men, like an evolutionary leap forward that we don't even control. Okay, so what can Christians bring to this conversation? Christians can bring to this conversation Christ. And we can talk about not trying to get beyond what it means to be human, but get to what it means to be truly human. And so when he talked here, when Dr. Peters talked about what it means to be truly human, he talked about, you know, the transcendence, and he talked about Christ being alive in a person. And what does it mean to grow up fully into Christ, who not only is the head and governance of your intellect and your mind, but actually your life and life eternal. So there you go. There's one takeaway of what a Christian can bring to the humanist conversation, or the transhumanist conversation. And we'll have more on that, because I only got halfway through my little what I learned. Okay, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me. You can catch up at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player, and never miss a conversation.